I'm very honored to present our next speaker, to introduce our next speaker, which is Nikita Dhawan, who will bring us, I guess, the decolonial perspective now. Dhawan is professor of political science and gender studies at Justus Liebig University in Gießen, and one of the principal voices in German-speaking academy post-colonial discourse. Her work analyzes the ambivalent legacy of the European Enlightenment for the post-colonial world and explores an alternative post-colonial queer feminist history of ideas of key concepts. In 2018, she created Colonial Repercussions, Planetary Utopias, Hope, Desire, Imaginaries in a Post-Colonial World at the Academy of Arts in Berlin with speakers like Angela Davis and Spivak. That was really impressive. So please welcome now our next speaker, Nikita Dhawan.
Thank you, Alia, for the kind introduction, and thank you, Beata and Alia, for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to be here. Now, my short input is an inadequate struggle with the questions whether art is a solution to global ills or art itself is a problem. And many of the previous speakers have tried to address this question, and I'm going to do the same. Now, on a daily basis, on a daily basis, we are flooded with images of suffering caused by factors ranging from war to political conflict to natural catastrophes and environmental destruction. While many respond to the pain of others, what Susan Sontag calls the pain of others with solidarity and empathy, others complain of compassion fatigue, empathie müdigkeit. Now, the question is whether radical and militant aesthetic practices can make us politically and ethically committed? Can it provoke us out of our indifference and irresponsibility? Could creative and affirmative artistic practices facilitate transnational justice, democracy, protecting and promoting human rights? Or is it better to rely on pie charts and statistics as more accurate and efficient and factual means of consciousness raising instead of artworks to convey global problems of poverty, war, and suffering? Can the artist function as an avant-garde? I like the Marxist term Trägerschicht, as an agent of decolonization in facilitating anti-racist, anti-imperialist, anti-orientalist artistic practices? Can radical politics of representation, and here I'm thinking about representation both in terms of Darstellung and Vertretung, facilitate a post-imperial politics? We know that historically, the perspective on art has been very ambivalent. So Plato, for example, says that art can be quite dangerous because it distorts reality, it corrupts and manipulates emotions. So in his idea of an ideal state, he banishes artists from the ideal community. More recently in history, we've seen the historical role of art in fascist and colonial regimes, which led to somebody like Adorno claiming that there can be no poetry after Auschwitz. And this is, I think, somehow a sign of historic grief and mourning for disenchanted aesthetics. So it was a kind of a puzzle, a struggle with a puzzle of how could the land of Bach, Goethe, and Kant produce Hitler, Goebbels, and Eichmann? How could a society with such sublime music, poetry, literature, philosophy commit such horrible crimes against humanity? And it was somehow also coming to terms with the failure of the Eurocentric civilizational ideal of Bildung. And I thought it was very, very well embodied in this Banksy image of art as distraction. So with these preliminary remarks, I'd like to now come to the core argument, which engages with the concept of useful art versus non-purposive art. Now, Tania Bruguera, as Alia already presented, focuses on the implementation of art in society, examining what it means to create useful art, and addresses the disparity of engagement between informed audiences and the general public, as well as the historical gap between the language used in what is considered avant-garde and the language of urgent politics. Now, in acquainting myself with her work, with her very inspiring work, I had to think of Adorno's juxtapositioning between Brecht and Beckett. In a conversation in 1967, Samuel Beckett mentioned to Adorno that Bertolt Brecht planned to write Anti-Godot. And the story goes that Adorno jotted down in his notebook, "My God, what a piece of crap that would have been." End of quote. This incident is instructive of the conflicting relation that Adorno had with Brecht and Beckett, and his relation on what Adorno calls committed versus autonomous art. In addition to Adorno's famous question of whether works of art can still come into being after all the catastrophes that have taken place, he also explored the non-function, and I've put non in brackets, of art in society. Even as autonomous art detached from social commitment was indefensible for Adorno, he belittled art that was in the service of political and ethical imperatives as sheer propaganda. Adorno explains that commitment is not merely an effort to improve a given situation, rather it seeks to transform the very preconditions that engender the situation. However, when art's will to change translates into direct political action, it ironically reproduces that against which it struggles. So here Adorno comes up with this very, very unique German term, Aktionismus, which is very difficult to translate into English. Art becomes a distraction from the very conditions it seeks to highlight, thereby functioning as an alibi and substitute for substantial transformation. Adorno warns that all efforts to restore art by giving it a social function of which art itself is uncertain, by which it expresses its own uncertainty, are doomed. Adorno accuses Brecht of disregarding the autonomy of art, whereby in its commitment to social and political transformation, art becomes purposive, zweckmäßig. So he's using a Kantian term of Unzweckmäßigkeit. An example of this is the doctrinal art of the Soviet Union since the 30s, which Adorno calls social or socialist realism. A lack of distance between art and social praxis is anathema to Adorno, who famously proclaims, and this is quite a provocative statement by Adorno, rather no art than socialist realism, end of quote. He criticizes Brecht's proximity to party communism as well as his conscious connection he makes between art and society in his Lehrstücke. In Adorno's view, Brecht's desire to educate the masses results in him instrumentalizing his art for a political purpose, thereby falling into realism. And yet, despite his political commitments, Adorno accuses Brecht of being more interested in theater than in changing the world. Adorno criticizes Brecht for not aspiring to appeal to humanistic values such as the good, truth, beauty, in place of classical conception of Aristotelian drama and inspiring empathy and affect. Brecht seeks to train the argumentative intellect in the theater, raising consciousness about alienation in capitalist society. However, in concerning himself with immediate facts of reality, according to Adorno, Brecht fails at abstracting from reality, thereby undermining the commitment and aspirations of his art. Adorno concludes that Brecht's lack of ambivalence and infantile simplification fails to capture the truth that involves innumerable meditations. Brecht's art only manages to depict reality superficially, thereby failing in his intentions, unlike Beckett, and now we come to the second part. And please bear with me, I'm taking so much time with Adorno because the last 5 minutes I'm going to engage with Spivak's aesthetic education, and she's deeply, deeply influenced and inspired by Adorno. So I wanted to show the connection. Very often there's this competition made between, you know, Holocaust studies and postcolonial studies, and I want to show how far postcolonial studies is influenced also by Holocaust studies. So Brecht's art only manages to depict reality superficially, thereby failing in his intentions, unlike Beckett, who does not resort to didactics to represent social suffering. Dismissing Brecht's manipulative technique, which prioritizes doctrine over form, Adorno foregrounds the ambiguity of autonomy or autonomous art that inspires instead of sermonizing, predigant. So for Adorno, political art is political instrumentalization of art. In contrast, autonomous art in his reading offers self-critical, reflexive art like the works of Beckett, which while being committed are like what Adorno calls Geschichtsphilosophische Sonnenuhren, historical philosophical sundials. Instead of merely mirroring empirical reality, artistic labor is an unconscious writing of history. Rather than promoting a specific ideology or being socially useful, the commitment of autonomous art lies in providing a counterpoint to existing social norms. Without being intentionally oppositional or transgressive, autonomous art criticizes society by merely existing. So what Adorno is saying, that rather than the self-representation of art that's revolutionary, militant, radical, he prefers art like Beckett's, which is absurd. Beckett's art in expressing the social experience of loss of meaning refuses the temptation to somehow grab meaning out of meaningless. By transforming language into an instrument of its own absurdity, Beckett frees the subject from purposive action. The senselessness of an action, Adorno argues, becomes the reason for doing it. Given that language has historically functioned as an instrument of domination, Beckett short-circuits language through his absurd logic. Without a single political word, Beckett's art still embodies commitment for Adorno insofar in purging the toxin of meaning. Beckett undermines positivism and inspires hope while denying it. In outlining absurdity of action, it inspires change. In Adorno's view, only art that rejects the principle of utility can go beyond what is towards a moment of transcendence, even as he's aware that autonomous art can become politically and socially inconsequential, upholding the status quo. Adorno is cognizant of the risk of falling into the trap of empiricism when inspiring to political transformation, even as he warns that radical art can become an alibi for the avoidance of intervening practice. Now, this tension between useful art and non-purposive art becomes even more pressing when one considers that art functions within structures of capitalism and neocolonialism. And I'd just like to share a little fun fact with you all, that the first public museum, which opened in 1779 in Kassel, was designed in the spirit of the Enlightenment idea of the public sphere. Now, Landgrave Friedrich Zwei sold soldiers to the British to finance this museum. Many of these soldiers were captured against their will and shipped over to North America to fight against the rebellion for independence in the British colonies. So now it becomes interesting to ask the fundamental question of the contamination of art. How is art financed? And here I thought I'd share a very interesting quote by Spivak, who says, "Capital is in fact borderless." That's the problem. And on the other hand, capital has to keep borders alive in order for this kind of cross-border trade to happen. So therefore, the idea of borderlessness has a performative contradiction within it, which has to be kept alive. Now, drawing on Kant, Schiller, Adorno, Spivak revisits the question of whether art or aesthetic practices is the solution to modern world's ills, or art itself is a problem. She takes inspiration from the intense conflict between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois to understand the role of an aesthetic education in the process of decolonization and desubalternization, namely activating participatory citizenship out of abject subjection without heroizing or romanticizing subaltern agency. So a quick footnote here about this conflict between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, and then I'll come to my last concluding remarks. So these are two of the most influential black intellectuals who had this horrible conflict. So Booker T. Washington was of the opinion after the American Civil War that the best path for freely former slaves who had been, recently freed was to become economically independent. Yeah. So he said what is very important for black men and women is to have access to wage labor. They should be able to sell their labor and get compensated for it, which is why he opened the Tuskegee Institute, which was a vocational training institute where black men, primarily black men, got training in got vocational training in developing skills. So they could become carpenters, plumbers, electricians, handwerker, basically. And be able to, yesterday we did this wonderful session on Marxism and postcolonial perspectives on Marxism. So here Booker T. Washington was of the opinion that to become from slaves to humans, it was very important to be economically independent. Du Bois very, very strongly disagreed with Booker T. Washington. He completely rejected this idea and said what is extremely important to decolonize the mind was to train the imagination. That in order for black men to make this transition from slaves into free citizens, they needed access to aesthetic education. And in order to do that, they needed to read canonical works. Booker T. Washington accused Du Bois of trying to behave like a white man. He says, what do you want us to do? Read Shakespeare? And Du Bois said yes, because Shakespeare speaks to me across the color line. And this is what Spivak, in a way, revisits in her book on aesthetic and her idea of aesthetic education, that decolonization, to a very, very large extent, of course, has to be about sovereignty. It has to be about rule of law. It has to be about democracy. However, it has to be, and here she uses the Derridian concept of supplementing. You cannot have active citizens without this training of the imagination. You have to invest in the political labor of training the imagination in order to be able to read and decode the world differently and our place in it. So she takes the Heideggerian concept of Welten, worlding the world, and says we need imagination in order to world the world differently, to imagine, to reimagine the world differently. And here, of course, the question of art, artistic practices, artistic art institutions becomes very, very important in the collective imagination of societies and citizens. What kinds of subjects and citizens are produced when we think about art and artistic practices? What kind of bodies are allowed to enter what kind of spaces? And who is excluded from these kinds of this kind of artistic labor? Who is heard? Who is allowed to speak? And who must remain silent? Now, I won't be able to go into all of this. I hope we can take up some of the points in the Q&A. But I'd like to end, because this is something that has been addressed and discussed in the morning session, about risk-taking, about failure, about the frustrations that go into doing political work. And here I'd like to end with two very inspiring insights that Spivak provides. One, she talks about, she basically talks about political practices, but I also think that is relevant for artistic practices, that she says that in a certain way, political practices and artistic, and I think that's where politics, ethics, and aesthetics in a certain way converge, that they are working without guarantees. Yeah. So all of us today in the morning got up and we brushed our teeth, right? I hope dental hygiene is a priority for all of us in this room. We brushed our teeth, and although I hope you know that it's quite a futile exercise. Because when you get up in the morning and you brush your teeth, there's absolutely no guarantee that you'll survive the day. Nobody in this world, keine Versicherungsfirma, no insurance company can give you a guarantee that you'll survive the day. And yet, each of us industriously practices, it's a very boring thing, first thing in the morning to get up and brush your teeth, and yet we do it in the hope that we'll become 80 and still be able to enjoy a baguette. Yeah? So in a certain way, brushing your teeth is a critique of mortality. It's a working against, it's counterfactual. We all know we're going to die. I know there are a lot of young people in the room, and it's not a very nice thing to talk about mortality. And yet, because I'm trained as a philosopher, and philosophy is all about learning to die and not just learning to live, this is what art is about and what artistic practice is about. It's not just about good intentions and not about incalculable consequences, but rather it's really this Beckett, this idea of Beckett, I can't go on, I must go on, ever tried, ever failed, try again, fail better. Yeah. So we keep brushing our teeth, although no guarantees about surviving the day. The second insight that I'd like to end with that Spivak shares with us is, and this is, again, my kind of very creative mapping of Spivak onto questions of art and aesthetic practices, is how art is both poison and medicine. That it can be, it can play a role in certain ways in transforming social, political, economic context, but it can also consolidate and cement hegemonic orders. So it can be both poison, but also counterpoison. Now, of course, the challenge for each of us in this room who is invested in artistic practices is to think about possibilities of converting poison into counterpoison, into medicine. Thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward to the Q&A.